Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the first in a two-part series that I have entitled mysteriously, hopefully excitingly, definitely alliteratively, The Mishloach Manot Myth. And my impetus for naming it as such is not because there is actually one specific myth when it comes to Mishloach Manot, but something that I have found now for many, many years is that it's not unique to Mishloach Manot. It's not unique to this specific mitzvah of Purim. I think, as a general rule, as has been well documented, the way we kind of live our lives as Jews is we often act with a certain degree of received wisdom, right? We do the things we do most of the time because we heard someone tell us, right? A family member, a friend, someone we know in the community just kind of told us very confidently and very authoritatively that we need to do X. Or that we can't do Y, and we kind of roll with it. And what I have found when it comes to Mishloach Manot is there is a lot of, and maybe insecurity is the wrong word, maybe uncertainty is better, but I find myself getting a lot of questions in the run-up to Purim about what people can and cannot give when it comes to Mishloach Manot. And hence the myths, because people will tell me very confidently, I've heard you cannot give X. Or I've heard you must give the following kinds of items. And ultimately, what I think it is again, it's just illustrative of the way we generally live our Jewish lives. But because this is my armchair psychology theory, because we are giving our Mishloach Manot to others, all of a sudden we start to doubt ourselves. We know deep down we've heard maybe something about what you can or can't do. But all of a sudden, I'm going to go knocking on the door of someone else. You might be giving it to me, you might be giving it to someone else, and you're like, oh my goodness, what if I make a mistake? What if I do the wrong thing? And so the panic sets in. And so I end up getting, and again, questions are always good. I like receiving questions, but I end up receiving a lot of questions. I heard you must do X or you cannot do Y when it comes to Mishloach Manot. And so what I want to do over this two-part series is actually explain and explore the mitzvah of Mishloach Manot for us to understand what it is we are actually obligated to do, what the purpose of this mitzvah is, and to truly understand genuinely the halachic obligation of Mishloach Manot as opposed to, what we just think. Just today, right? It wasn't a plant, but Shai came up to me and he's like, Abba, is it true that you don't need, right, two items of two different brachot? And I said, that is correct. And he was happy he knew that. We tend to think that's true. As we'll see next week, it's definitely not. And if we believe it to be true, we're accusing many of the great rabbis of the recent past who have never fulfilled the mitzvah of Mishloach Manot. But what I want to focus on tonight is less the practical specific instances and issues regarding giving Mishloach Manot. The practical halacha will please God talk about next week. But instead, I want to focus tonight on the purpose of Mishloach Manot. Because even though there is usually in Judaism somewhat of a Pandora's box when it comes to the realm of what we call ta'amei ha-mitzvot, speculating regarding the reasons, the justifications, the purpose behind mitzvot, there are some where there is a very transparent reason or reasons that are suggested, and it's crucial to understand what the purpose or purposes suggested are behind certain mitzvot, because as we'll see, so much of the practical halacha is actually going to emerge from understanding why we are obligated to give Mishloach Manot in the first place. And so I think tonight will be, right, learning these sources, even though even for me, some of these sources I was familiar with, I was actually having a great time writing this shiur because just coming across some of the ideas, some of the perspectives suggested that there's some really cool sources we're going to see in a little bit. But we start with, as I share the source sheet right now on the screen, we start with the Megillah itself. So right at the end of the Megillah, chapter 9. The story ends, but this is where we get the laws of Purim. And two different verses in the, I would say the second, the third third, the beginning of the third third, end of the second third, not really important. Right, in the ninth chapter of Megillat Esther, in two different verses we get, the instruction of Mishloach Manot. Al Kain HaYehudim HaPrazim HaYoshvim Ba'arei HaPrazot Ad Yom Arba'as Al HaChodesh Adar. Right, the Jews who live in unwalled towns, they celebrate Purim on the 14th. Simcha u'mishta v'yom tov, right? A day of joy, a day of merrymaking, a yom tov, a holiday. U'mishloach manot ish l're'ehu, and a day of sending mishloach manot, of sending gifts to one another. And then a couple of verses later, koyomim asher nachu v'hem hayudim oiveihem, avachodesh nepach lohem miyagon simcha u'me'eva l'yom tov, right? On the days on which, right, we're talking about the creation almost of Purim, right? We're celebrating on the days where, right, our sadness was turned to joy, etc., etc., etc. La'asot otam, they were made into yemei mishta u'simcha, again, days of merrymaking, days of joy, u'mishloach manot ish l're'ehu, sending gifts to one another, u'matanot le'evyonim, and also gifts to the poor, charity to the poor also. Twice in Megillat Esther, in its ninth chapter, it insists that one of the major purposes of Purim is Mishloach Manot, sending gifts, and indeed, right, it's uncontroversial, absolutely not much to say, right, it is one of the mitzvot of Purim. Interestingly, there is a beautiful phrasing of Rav Yitzchak Mirsky, who's the author of a series of svarim called Hegeyone Halacha, and he has a really, really beautiful kind of framing of Purim. It's somewhat of a side point, but I think it's interesting in the way the Megillah itself phrases it, where it's the days where kind of the sadness was turned to joy, you know, the darkness was turned to light, etc., etc., etc. Right? He points out that actually Purim is, right, Purim preserves that, because we actually start with fasting, right, which indicates kind of the sadness, and we transition from that fasting, from that mourning, from that difficult experience into the joy of Purim. And so, right, this year it's kind of different because Tanit Esther, the fast of Esther, is pulled back a few days because Purim is Saturday night and we don't fast on Shabbat for Tanit Esther. But this idea that actually we experience the full gamut of emotions around the Purim period very much mirrors the experience of the Jewish people, you know, during the Purim story. But crucially, one way we exhibit the joy of Purim is through Mishloach Manot, and the Gemara, source number two, just very, very simply, right, codifies, right, Tonei Rav Yosef u'Mishloach Manot Ish L'Reyehu. What does that mean? Shtei Manot L'Ish Echad. Your obligation is to give two portions of manot, of food, le'ish echad, to one person, u'matanot le'evyonim, shtei matanot li'shnei b'nei adam. When it comes to gifts to the poor, right, you have to give that to two people. That's the principle of Mishloach Manot. But again, right, the Megillah just says for us to do so. And the Gemara just says, yep, kind of gives us a little bit more information of how exactly you fulfill it. That's often what the Gemara does. There is, however, a well-known and fascinating debate regarding why we are actually obligated in Mishloach Manot. And the first opinion is by Rabbi Yisrael Isselin, the Trumat Hadeshen, who lived in the 15th century in what is nowadays Slovenia, a deeply influential halachic figure. This is a complete aside, but a very, very important aside when we compare the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, right? The Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Karo being the defining rabbi of the Sfardi world, the Ramah being the defining rabbi of the Ashkenazi world, they have fundamentally different methodological approaches. We often talk about the era of the Rishonim, which is the medieval era, which roughly begins, right, at the end of the Gaonic period, and, right, and the Shulchan Aruch is the end of the Rishonic period. But you can actually draw a line even within that. When we think of the classic Rishonim, the classic medieval rabbis, your Rashis, your Rambams, your Riths, your Roshes, they were all early on in this period. There was another group of rabbis who existed generally in more in Europe, right, in the, or were better known in Europe, in the second half of this kind of Rishonic period. The Shulchan Aruch defers to the earlier Rishonim, right? Rif, Rambam, and Rosh are his people. The Ramah, the defining rabbi of Ashkenazi Jewry, shows far more deference towards the later Rishonim. They tended to live in Poland and Germany. So the Trumat Hadeshen is incredibly influential because he lived, you know, not much earlier than the time of the Ramah. And so his halachic perspectives are very, very crucial and very, very influential on halacha, particularly within the Ashkenazi world. What's also interesting about the Trumat Hadeshen, famously, usually when you come across responsa teshuvot, someone sends in a question, and the rabbi gives the answer. The Trumat Hadeshen wrote his own questions, right? He answered things that he found interesting. So if we take a look at now at source number three, and the Trumat Hadeshen is asked or asks, B'nei Adam Hasholchim L'chavreihem B'Purim, right? So people who send to their friends on Purim, Chalukim V'Sadinim U'Kahai Gavna, right? They send, right, robes, sheets, and the like. Right, clothing, other gifts of value and note. Yotze'im yedei mishloach manot olav. Right, do they fulfill the commandment of sending mishloach manot or not? Right, let's say you decided you want to give me mishloach manot, but you want to instead give me an Amazon gift card. Hint, hint, cough, cough. Right, the Trumat Hadeshen, is asking, is answering. Right, can you actually do that? Does that count? Do you fulfill your obligation of Mishloach Manot when you give me the Amazon gift card, thank you in advance? The Trumat Hadeshen says the following. Yira'a, it appears, de'ein yotze'im bohen. You do not fulfill the commandment with non-food items. De'nira'a ta'am de Mishloach Manot, for the reason they instituted Mishloach Manot. K'dei she'yehei l'chol echad, so that each and every person will have dai v'sipeg l'kayim ha'se'uda k'din. Everyone will have enough and what's sufficient in order to have their seuda the way it is obligated, right? There's also the mitzvah on Purim of a seuda, of eating a festive meal. Says the Trumat Hadeshen, Mishloach Manot is not really about sending gifts. It's actually about giving people food for their seuda. Understood this way, Mishloach Manot is just a derivative of another mitzvah on Purim, which is the mitzvah of seuda. Right? So what you, and again, we'll talk the practical implications of this view next week, but for now, it seems very clear that what you need to give are meal items. Right? The kinds of items a person can then take and serve at and eat at their Purim seuda. The purpose is each and every Jew needs to have what to eat to be able to have a seuda on Purim, and therefore the obligation of Mishloach Manot exists in order to serve that need. That is the view of the Trumat Hadeshen. There is an alternative view suggested by Rabbi Shlomo Alkabetz. So Rav Shlomo Alkabetz lived in the 16th century Tzfat, and he's a rabbi, he's a Kabbalist, a poet. He's best known as the composer of Lecha Dodi. Right? We sing Lecha Dodi every Friday night. Rav Shlomo Alkabetz wrote that. He's also was like a friend of Rav Yosef Karo. But he also has, right, he also wrote other things, including a work entitled Manot HaLevi, which is a commentary to Megillat Esther. And he writes the following in two different places in explaining the obligation of Mishloach Manot. Ki ze romeis ki heim ba'aguda achat uva ahava va'achva. That the point of Mishloach Manot is to indicate that we are a people who are united in love and friendship. Hefeich masha amru hatzora, in order to kind of refute it's the opposite of what the enemy said, describing us as mefuzah umforad. And similarly, in another comment, just another couple of verses later, he says, right, what's the point of Mishloach Manot? Lehi kohel kol echad im chaveru, to bring, right, to unite people together. Hafach ish tsar oyev, to reverse that which, the enemy and adversary said. Lashon Ramiya ha'omer am echad mefuzar, who said, right, he described us as a scattered people. He's referring, obviously, to Haman, who in the third chapter of Megillat Esther, in framing why it behooves Achashverosh to exterminate the Jews, right? Vayomer Haman, boo, lemelech Achashverosh, yeshno am echad mefuzah umforad. There is a certain people scattered and dispersed, bein ha'amim, among the other peoples, b'chol medinat malchutecha, right? They are in all of your provinces. V'dateim shonot mikol am, v'datei ha'melech einam osim, v'lamelech ein shoveh la'hanicham, right? They don't listen to your laws, you should not tolerate their existence. But it's this reference to Haman describing the Jewish people as scattered and dispersed. Says the Manot HaLevi, says Rav Shlomo Alkabetz, the whole point of Mishloach Manot is to redress that accusation. If we send each other Mishloach Manot, that increases the sense of friendship, fraternity, right? Peace and happiness among us. If you give me a gift on Purim, I'm like, that's so sweet. Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate it. I feel warmer towards you for giving me a gift. When I give you a gift, you feel warmer and happier towards me because, again, I gave you something. Says the Rav Shlomo Alkabetz, the purpose of Mishloach Manot is simply to increase a sense of love and fraternity within the Jewish people. Trumat HaDeshen, it's all about the Seuda, the meal. Rav Shlomo Alkabetz, the Manot HaLevi, it's all about love and fraternity being increased, friendship being increased within the Jewish people. You can already start to understand that there's a lot of practical and wider applications to this debate. And Rambam very much frames the obligation of Mishloach Manot in the way I did earlier, as a fulfillment, really, of the Seuda. In source number 6 in his Laws of Megillah, Rambam says the following, Ketzad chovat Seuda zo. How do you fulfill your obligation of Seuda? Sheyochal basar, you should eat meat. Vitokein Seuda na'eh, and you should make sure you prepare a very nice meal, kafi asher timtza yado, right? And you should make sure, you know, whatever's within your abilities to, right? You should make as nice a meal as possible within your capabilities. Veshote yayin, and you should drink wine, ad sheyishtaker, until you are intoxicated to the point, v'yeradim b'shchirato, so that you fall asleep. V'chein, therefore, hayav adam, every single person is obligated, lishloach shtei manot basar, two portions of meat, or shnei minei tavshil, or two other kinds of cooked dishes, or shnei minei achalin, or two other kinds of food, lechaveiro, to your friend, shne'emar, as it is written, umishloach manot ish l're'ehu, to send gifts to one another, shtei manot l'ish echad, send two gifts to each person, v'chol hamarbe lishloach l're'em imishubach, and if you send more, that's even better, right? Obviously, you don't need to just fulfill your obligation with one singular mishloach manot, v'im ein lo machalif im chaveiro. And if you don't have the capability to give Mishloach Manot, and this line of Rambam is going to come up very, very soon and be very, very important. And if you can't do this, swap meals. Swap your Seuda meals. Kedei lekayem u'mishloach manot ish l'reihu, to still make sure you fulfill the obligation to send mishloach manot to one another. Rambam very, very clearly, right? He came before the Trumat HaDeshen, but is very, very clearly in the same school of thought as Trumat HaDeshen, v'chvein. Right? There is an obligation of Seuda, and therefore, in detailing this obligation of Seuda, Rambam points out we are also obligated in Mishloach Manot. Mishloach Manot are completely a derivative of the obligation of Seuda. However, there is a fascinating alternative understanding of what Rambam just quoted, which is this idea of swapping meals, which is worth noting. So first of all, it comes from the Gemara in Megillah. So the Gemara in Megillah simply tells you, Abaye bar Avin, v'Rabbi Chanina bar Avin, right? Machalfei Seudataitu lahadade, right? These two Rabbonim, right? They swapped meals with one another, right? How does Rambam explain that? Right? What it means is they exchanged them as Mishloach Manot. If you look in the Steinsaltz, the Koran translation, Rav Steinsaltz says the same thing, right? They gave Mishloach Manot through swapping their meals to one another. Rif, similarly, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, Umishloach Manot Ishlarehu. So Rif is very, very important. Whenever I mention the Rif, it's always important to make this comment. The Rif is one of the most important and early of the Rishonim. The way he wrote his work is he basically rewrote the Gemara, and he only kept in the things that he thought were halachically relevant. And the way he frames it and the way he puts things together also indicates his view. So what the Rift does is he takes actually two sources we've now already seen and he puts them together as one continuous story or one continuous principle. Umishloach manot ishlerehu manachnot levyonim, right? The verse says, give mishloach manot, tane Rav Yosef, shtei manot la'adam echad, right? You should give two gifts to one person, umatanot le'evyonim, shtei matanot le'shnei b'nei adam. You also need to give two gifts to two different poor people. Abaye bar avin, Rav Hananya bar avin, havu machlifi se'udatan lahadade. Right, they would exchange their gift, their meals with one another in order to fulfill Mishloach Manot. According to Rif and Rambam, how do we understand source 7? How can you fulfill Mishloach Manot? So let's say you're making chicken and rice for your Seuda, right? And you don't have any other way of giving Mishloach Manot. So you take your chicken and rice and you put them in one of those giant, foil pans. And you go over and you knock on, your next door neighbor who's also celebrating Purim, and you're like, "Hi, I made your chicken and rice," and they give you right their meal that they've just made. That is the interpretation of Source 7, per Rambam, per Rif, right? Not only is Mishloach Manot a derivative of the Seuda, but they are possibly the same thing, right? They don't have to be. But they can actually be the same thing. If you cook your Seuda on Purim day and you give that meal to someone else, you have fulfilled your obligation of Mishloach Manot. The Bach, Rav Yoel Sirkis, again, a very, very influential figure. He has a commentary on the Torah, the precursor to the Shulchan Aruch. He, however, suggests otherwise. He disagrees with this interpretation of source number 7. And he finds his rooting in Rashi. So I mentioned before, you look in the Koran Gemara and you see Rav Steinsaltz tell you how to understand it. And it's always important to remember that when we're using aids to study the Gemara, and they're very valuable and very important and very helpful, right? They are always going to interpret it in kind of the simplest way possible. But that can sometimes skate over and mask the fact that there are multiple interpretations and multiple understandings, which is why it is important for us to sometimes dive into the commentaries and try to understand what's going on, right? How to interpret different aspects of within the Gemara. Rashi explains source number 7 fundamentally differently. No, Abaye bar Avin and Rabbi Chanina bar Avin did not simply swap meals in order to fulfill the Seuda, in order to fulfill Mishloach Manot. They had a different arrangement, says Rashi, source number 9. Zeh ochel im zeh bepurim shel shana zo. One year, right, Rabbi Chanina went over to Abaye's house. Uveshnia, and in the second year, so'ed chaveiro imo. And then the following year, right, Abaye went over to Rabbi Chanina's house. It's not, source number 7 says, Rashi is not teaching us some law of the Purim, of Mishloach Manot, the way the Rif understood it, the way Rambam understood it. No. What the source number 7 is teaching us is an adorable arrangement between two members of Chazal, who, I mean, their fathers both have the same name, so I'm assuming they're brothers, right? They had Purim together, right? Some people do have the very beautiful custom of always having the Purim Seuda with, right, the same groups of people. Sometimes it's always at the same house, sometimes it rotates around houses, but, right, that is per Rashi's understanding of source number 7. Source number 7 is teaching us nothing about Mishloach Manot per se, at least understood, I would say, in its simplest way. However, the Bach Rav Yoel Sirkis says, no. Source number 7 is all about Mishloach Manot, even if you follow Rashi's train of thought. The Bach says the following, source number 10. Ela kachu ha-perush. This is the explanation. Dekevan de ta'am mishloach manot hu kedei sheyehe sameach v'sos im ohavav v're'av l'hoshkin b'neihem ahava v'achva v're'ah. The whole point of mishloach manot is that everyone will be happy, everyone will love one another, you'll enjoy the time with your friends, right? There'll be a sense of fraternity, there'll be the sense of synonyms of fraternity, right? Ahava v'achva v're'ah, right? Friendship, all of these things, right? The point of Mishloach Manot is to inculcate this sense of friendship and fraternity. Im kein, thus, im yisod echad im chaveiro v're'ehu. If you eat with your friend your Purim Seuda, harei heim besimcha v'tov leiv, Mishta Yachad, right? You're going to enjoy yourself. It's going to be a joyous moment. Upaturim heim me'ata mechiyuv mishloach manot. And you don't need to give mishloach manot anymore. The Bach's fascinating interpretation of Source 7 is, it wasn't that they swapped meals. It wasn't that they gave the chicken and rice to each other. Oh, this is your mishloach manot, thank you. I take my mishloach manot. No. If you eat together and you have that sense of joy, that sense of community, that sense of friendship, that's mishloach manot. If you come to my house on Purim for a Purim Seuda, and you therefore feel, oh, this is so nice, right? This was such a nice thing to do, right? I feel such a bond. That's mishloach manot. This falls far more in line with Rav Shlomo Alkabetz. The Trumat Hadeshen, in contrast, Rav Yisrael Isselin, it's all about the Se'uda. Mishloach Manot is a derivative of, its purpose is to ensure you can eat a festive meal on Purim. That's Rambam, that's Rif. That is one entire school of thought. And we won't talk about the practicalities right now, but there is obvious clarity as to what you are therefore giving for Mishloach Manot. Because if you're supposed to give the kind of food that can be eaten at a Seuda, right, that, right, we all instinctively know what counts and what doesn't, right? Potentially creates problems because all of a sudden that chocolate bar you were going to give someone to count as Mishloach Manot, right? Very few people eat chocolate as part of their Purim Seuda. But fundamentally, right, the Trumat Hadeshen, it's a very clear and very obvious idea. Mishloach Manot is food for the Seuda. You are essentially providing other people with a Seuda. And by the way, and it's a very interesting point that just occurs to me, I think it's a very interesting point, right? We usually find Mishloach Manot to be a relatively easy obligation, right? The idea that really you only give it to one person always just seems like, okay, I guess. But if you think about it as food for a meal, all of a sudden it kind of makes sense why you'd only give it to one person. Because if I'm going to, right, there's only so many chickens you can cook, right? There's only so many bottles of wine you can give, right? So all of a sudden you give it to one person, right? And that's why the way Rambam frames it, if you can give it to more people, great, knock yourself out. But really you're only giving it to one person because you're giving them a seuda, you're making someone a meal. And that's something that realistically, right, that's one person to one person. You can't do much more than that. That's the view of the Trumat Hadeshen. Very, again, how exactly we understand this practically, we'll talk about next week. But there is a lot of obvious clarity, I would say, in what exactly is the direction Mishloach Manot is moving. In contrast, we have Rav Shlomo Alkabetz and the Bach, who give this very amorphous, very fluffy, very cuddly interpretation of Mishloach Manot, which is, it's all about making people feel happy. It's all, a nice hug, maybe, is Mishloach Manot, right? An arm around the shoulder, a thoughtful note, right? In theory, if Mishloach Manot is all about creating senses of love and friendship and this and that, Rav Shlomo Alkabetz for sure would say that the Amazon gift card counts as Mishloach Manot, because you give me a Mishloach Manot, you give me an Amazon gift card, and I'm really touched and I appreciate it, right? But like any gesture you do, right? And that's what's phenomenal about the Bach's comment here in source number 10, right? If you invite someone to your Seuda, Mishloach Manot doesn't apply anymore because, right, people appreciate being invited to meals. They feel good in and of itself. You've created that warm fuzziness through Mishloach Manot, and therefore for that, through your Purim Seuda, through your invitation, and therefore you have fulfilled your obligation of Mishloach Manot. But, right, it does not necessarily give us the most helpful perspective to take. It seems to be very wide. And the truth is, right, very, very beautifully, Rav Shlomo Alkabetz's commentary to the Megillat Esther, he gave as Mishloach Manot. You may have noticed it's called Manot Halevi. So in the introduction, I'll admit here that I pulled the translation from Safaria, and still the translation didn't make a lot of sense. So my translation here of some of this is a little bit iffy, but the important point I understand, and that's really, but it's actually interesting to just read a little bit of his. He has a very, very long introduction to his work, and he says the following. Source number 11, Bi o Megillat Esther Hevantav, Chevartav, Af Asitav Ani, right? I made it, I wrote it, I did it, right? I did this commentary. I, Shlomo Halevi ben Alkametz, his name. Yovel Shai Lichvod Yakatiferet Chot Ni Gviv Nasa Leshemu Tfila Tehila Rodif Tzaka Vachesed Hanavon Kvod Harav Yitzchak Vuhu Kohen Lekel Elyon. So he gives, right, raise your hand if you've ever used such superlatives to describe your father-in-law. Right, but the or if you are a father-in-law, if you've ever been described by your son-in-law in such superlatives, I can't think of many people who can. But right, you know, he's honorable, glorious, right, powerful, right. He's praised. He pursues tzedakah and kindness, and he's honorable, right, and he's the priest, right. He's the Kohen Lekel Elyon, right. He's the priest of the Most High, right. This is superlatives and then some. And then basically he continues to say, and again, my exact understanding of what he's writing here is a little bit iffy, but it's basically like, thank you for giving me your daughter's hand in marriage, right. And therefore, just and instead of sending that which people usually send on Purim, and now in the bold, shalachti bi ozer shaloach elav. I have sent my father-in-law this commentary, ve'ekrashemo manot halevi, right? The mishloach manot of Shlomo halevi. And then he tells us the year. Right? Rav Shlomo Alkabetz really believed the whole point of Mishloach Manot was to increase conviv. So the word I wrote down, conviviality, not sure that's how you pronounce it, but there's you also pronounce it differently in American and British that I do know. So sure, I pronounced it correct. You don't know the difference. But it's about increasing love and friendship. So you know what? The Manot HaLevi Rav Shlomo Alkabetz wrote a commentary to Megillat Esther as a gift to his father-in-law as Mishloach Manot. Trumat HaDeshen would turn around and say, well, that didn't work. That failed. But obviously Rav Shlomo Alkabetz himself believes, no, if you send something that's a nice gesture, that increases this sense of love, right? If you write someone, right, a bespoke work in their honor, they'll take that the right way. They'll appreciate that. And so he sent it's beautiful. He sent his commentary to Megillah. He wrote as Mishloach Manot. And he was not the only one. Famously, the Ramah. And also, this is just an indication of some of the practical questions that emerge when it comes to Mishloach Manot. The Ramah in source number 12 codifies the following halacha. Ve'im sholeach manot l're'ehu. If you send mishloach manot to someone, let's say I give you mishloach manot, v'hu eino rotzeh l'kavlam, and you say no thanks, I don't want this. Or and ostensibly you're not saying it because you hate me, you don't want it, or you don't need it. I give you right. You are gluten. You're celiac. You can't eat gluten, and I come with a nice banana bread I just made, and you're like, I appreciate the thought, but you forgot I was celiac. I can't have this. Or mochalo, or you just kind of like, no. Thank you. You fulfilled your obligation, but I forgive you your obligation to give it. Yatza, you have fulfilled your obligation, says the Rama. How can that be? Right? If we follow the view of the Trumat Hadeshin that you need to be giving food for the Seuda, if someone doesn't accept your food or just kind of forgives you your obligation, how can you have fulfilled your obligation? So the Chatam Sofer, who kind of very much is best known for talking about this debate between the Trumat HaDeshen and Rav Shlomo Alkabetz, says the Rama must be squarely in the camp of Rav Shlomo Alkabetz. The Rama must believe that the sole purpose of Mishloach Manot is nothing to do with the Seuda and everything to do with increasing this sense of right joy, Right? So with gifts, it's the thought that counts. So if I knock on your door with Mishloach Manot that you don't want, but you appreciate I gave it you. And so we've still increased that sense of friendship, that sense of achva. And therefore, right, it still counts. And indeed, this might explain why the Rama himself also wrote a commentary to Megillat Esther that he sent as Mishloach Manot. So as the Rama has a commentary to Megillat Esther called Mechir Yayin. And at the very, very end, he says, right, Shalachni b'mei Purim lemana le'avi Yisrael, right? He sent it as Mishloach Manot to his father, Yisrael, right? There's actually a fascinating story behind this. In 1550, so this was literally, I have the notes right here. So in 1556, the Rama lived in Krakow. There was a plague. And so he was forced to leave the city, right? Everyone kind of fled Krakow. But basically, everyone was then in poverty, right? Food was very scarce. And so the Rama had no ability to, right, quite frankly, enjoy Purim. But he also had no ability to send Mishloach Manot to anyone that was food. So he decided instead to write a commentary to the Megillah, give it to his father, who was one of the major figures in the Krakow community. And that way, right, he fulfilled the obligation of Mishloach Manot. The Rama also wrote a book as Mishloach Manot because the Rama believes at the end of the day, it's not about giving someone tangible, actionable food they can then eat at their Sa'uda, but it's about increasing this sense of friendship, this love between people. Right? That's what the purpose of Mishloach Manot is all about. And so what we've seen tonight are the two core perspectives on Mishloach Manot. The first of which, on one extreme, is that the fundamental purpose of Mishloach Manot is to provide people food for the Seuda. And indeed, Mishloach Manot is actually a derivative of the obligation of the Seuda, as Rambam said, v'chein. Right? You have an obligation to eat the following things at a Seuda, and therefore, you must give Mishloach Manot to others so that they have food for their Seuda. That is one perspective. It's got a lot of clarity. It's very obvious, even if it's perhaps intense, the demands it makes of an individual. And perhaps that's why, technically speaking, you only have to give one person Mishloach Manot because, right, the bar is pretty high as to maybe what you would need to give. On the complete other side of the spectrum is Rav Shlomo Alkabetz, who says, no, 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 no. It's all about hugs and cuddles, unicorns and rainbows, right? Ultimately, it's about creating this sense of love between people. And understood this way, quite frankly, I think all of us would rather cook a meal for someone than write a book for someone. But you can write books. You can do anything, right? Anything that, per the Bach, just invite someone to your Seuda, Mishloach Manot. Right? Anything you do to increase a sense of love between people counts as Mishloach Manot. And so, please God, next week, when we get into the true practical applications of what you can and cannot give for Mishloach Manot, and we will probably slaughter myth after myth after myth after myth after myth of what we believe Mishloach Manot requires, we'll have to keep these two kind of poles in our mind directing us as to what Mishloach Manot needs to be. Because if we are required to give a Seuda, the intensity, the requirement is going to be very high. If we are simply required to create a sense of friendship, it's very, very easy to fulfill Mishloach Manot. But next week we will see there are actually a surprisingly large number of cases, a surprisingly large number of scenarios, a surprisingly large number of details that govern not just what you give for Mishloach Manot, but potentially perhaps what you might be required to give almost bespoke Mishloach Manot to different people, which again will in part depend on and hinge on all of the groundwork we've laid tonight in talking about the two contrasting purposes behind Mishloach Manot.